You might think Grammarly is a fancy spell check, but your team has been using and loving it for years because it does way more than you realize. Grammarly's AI can write an instant first draft in a few clicks, not a few hours. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This week on the podcast, what can I say? Another great conversation with an extra special guest. Steve Case really is legendary in everything from putting America online, full pun intended, to being the first internet company to go public, the largest merger in history with AOL Time Warner. And you would think that's enough of a resume, but he didn't stop there. He basically set up a foundation, joined the Giving Pledge, and became very active in both policy and entrepreneurship. Revolution is the outgrowth of his family office that does everything from seed to venture to growth investing. He was instrumental in getting a number of very positive policy actions passed over the past decade. And now he is taking his act on the road and revealing to much of America how much energy and entrepreneurship there is away from the big money centers like New York and San Francisco in the heartland of America. And his new book, Rise of the Rest, describes that experience. I found this conversation to be fascinating. And if you are at all interested in technology, venture, startups, entrepreneurship, I suspect you will also. So with no further ado, my conversation with Steve Case. I've interviewed a number of people from Revolution. I've spoken to your wife about the Case Foundation. But let's talk about your background. Your entrepreneurial career really begins in 1985 when you co-found America Online, which turned out to be the first internet company to go public. Tell us a little bit about the founding of AOL. Where did this idea come from, and what was that experience like?
Well, it was an interesting journey. I actually stumbled onto the idea of the internet in 1979, 1980. I was a senior in college. I was hearing about these things called video text and teletext, and interactive TV, and the thing in Minitel in France, and Prestel in the UK, all these interactive services. I was really intrigued, and I read a book by Alvin Toffler, the futurist, called The Third Wave. And he basically was talking about this coming kind of electronic frontier, electronic cottage. And I was smitten. I was mesmerized. So I knew I wanted to do that. But when I graduated from college in 1980, there were no internet companies to go to work for because it still was more of an idea. And venture capitalists back then weren't backing, 21-year-olds coming out of college. So I decided to work for some big companies, Royal Procter & Gamble and then PepsiCo. Then moved to the Washington, D.C. area to join a startup that failed. But thankfully, two of the people I met there, Jim Kimsey and Mark Serif, and I co-founded America Online in 1985. Back then, only 3% of people were online, and those 3% were only on an hour a week. So it was still pretty early days in terms of the internet, but really believed that someday the internet would be pervasive, that it would be a mainstream phenomenon. And we set out to try to get America online.
Yeah, this internet thing is going to be big one day. I think you were early in that assessment. So I was going to ask you why such a something so fundamental block and tackling is access, but really the answer is there was no access back then, or other than mainframes at universities and the Department of Defense, very few people in the real world had internet.
Well, actually, when we started in 1985, it was the internet was restricted to government agencies and educational institutions.
Wow.
So actually, it was illegal for businesses or consumers to be on the internet in 1985. A few years later, Congress passed the Telecom Act to commercialize the internet. So when we were getting started, we had to create sort of this parallel world, our own kind of email systems, our own servers, because we couldn't connect to the internet. But we knew it was only a matter of time before those worlds would blur together, merge together. And in our early days, we really just tried to figure out, like many startups, how to get noticed, stay alive. It was frankly harder because we were in the Northern Virginia area outside of Washington, D.C. There was no venture capital there. We had to raise money from other places. People were reluctant to leave a big company to go to a small company. So there are a lot of challenges that we face. Frankly, it helps inspire some of the work we're now doing with Rise of the Rest. How do we back entrepreneurs in places outside of Silicon Valley? I think my own experience building AOL in one of those forgotten places, left behind places that people don't think of as startup kind of hubs, kind of helped inform some of that work. And it took us a while. Eventually, in the mid-90s, the internet became more of a mainstream phenomenon, hit a tipping point. But for the better part of a decade, it was a struggle. There were a couple of times we almost hit the wall, had to go through some layoffs. It was not obvious to most people that the internet would ever be something more than a niche kind of hobbyist kind of phenomenon.
Huh.
Even when we went public, it was 1992.
Really?
It was we raised a whopping $10 million in our IPO. The value of the company that day was $70 million. Basically, nobody knew or cared what we were doing. Nobody really was that interested at the time in the internet. We had been at it for coming on a decade, had only a couple hundred thousand customers. But thankfully, the next decade, things really accelerated in terms of the growth of the company, the growth in the valuation, things like that. But it's also, I think, a lesson for me that I try to carry into the work we now do with Revolution, that sometimes revolutions happen in evolutionary ways. It's not an overnight success. There's a slog before finally you build some momentum, and that was my experience with AOL. The first decade was hard and slow. The second decade, really, things really took off.
So was DC just a coincidence of where you happen to be located, or was that lack of legislative permission part of the reason you had to locate close to Congress and push that forward so they basically allowed the rest of us to get online?
No, the reason I moved to D.C. was more of an accident. There was an interesting company, what I thought was an interesting company, that I joined in 1983 that had a service called GameLine. And at the time, you may recall this, some of your listeners may not, but very few people had home computers, but a lot of people had Atari game machines. And so the idea of this product was you plug the game cartridge that had a communications capability, a modem built in, and you could download video games, almost like having an in-home arcade, like a Netflix for video games.
So it's a modem and a storage device.
Yeah, it looked like a game cartridge, but you also had a phone connection. And so I thought this was a great way to kind of enter that world that I'd been reading about and wanting to get into. But unfortunately, just as the product came to market, the whole Atari game market blew up, and retailers didn't want any new products, and suddenly things were looking pretty desperate. But that's why I moved to the area. And then because I was already there, and these two people I mentioned were also part of that company, the three of us, kind of co-founded America Online, brought some of the team from that previous company with us. So it was accidental to be there, but it turned out to be an advantage because, as you say, one of the things that we had to spend a lot of time in the early days of the internet was public policy, getting the regulations right, commercializing the internet, getting things right for e-commerce, trying to keep the internet safe for kids, things like that. And being in the Washington, D.C. area proved to be important. And frankly, it's proven to be important again now as we're investing, because policy is becoming much more of a front and center issue for more and more companies in health tech, sports tech, food and ag. These are sectors where there's some regulations, and entrepreneurs need to understand that. Investors need to understand that. So I think we kind of have a little bit of home court advantage being located in Washington, D.C., and having a front row seat in terms of understanding how Congress works and things happen, which I think bodes well for this next phase of innovation where policy is much more central.
We're definitely going to talk about the Jobs Act and some of the public service you've done, but I want to stick with AOL as the first internet company to go public, subsequently runs up 11,616%, not too shabby. Tell us what your experience was like being at the helm of a company as it went public.
Well, the early days were still a little slow, but then finally in 95, 96, 97, things really took off, and our growth dramatically accelerated. We went from a couple hundred thousand customers to tens of millions of customers. That market cap I mentioned when we went public of 70 million at a peak, I think it was 8 years later, is $160 billion. Mm-hmm. So it really was quite a ride, and we went from having less than 200 employees when we went public to 8 years later having 10,000 employees, and then wow. We merged with Time Warner, and suddenly it was 90,000 employees. So it was quite a kind of a rocket ship, and I recognized as the company was scaling, I, as the leader, as a CEO, needed to constantly rethink what my job should be, what I should focus on, constantly rejigger things with the team, building the team for the business we'd have a couple of years from now, not from the business we had today, or certainly the business we had in the past. So it was a rapid pace of learning a lot in terms of being a public company, growing so rapidly. And also I recognized, because AOL was sort of at the time kind of the leader in the United States, that I had a role to play in not just running a company, but being sort of an evangelist for the medium and advocate for the medium, and, mm-hmm. and try to weigh in on policy issues to try to make sure the internet really had a chance to flourish.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You mentioned the AOL Time Warner merger. At the time, it was the largest merger in history. And somehow you guys, AOL shareholders, ended up with a majority of the stock, even though Time Warner was arguably a much larger, more established company. What was that process like of negotiations? Did you approach them? Did they come to you? Tell us how that came about.
Well, it came about because AOL had been growing rapidly and was a leader in what was then called the dial-up era, the narrowband era, where you were connecting your computers to phone lines. But we needed a path to broadband, and the best path was cable systems, mm-hmm. which had high-speed access. And so strategically, there was a real value in merging with Time Warner. And we also believed as the internet evolved and you had higher speed, you'd have more multimedia content, and having some of the brands that the Warner Brothers studios and Warner Music mm-hmm. and CNN and HBO and so forth, all part of this company would advantage us. And similarly, Time Warner is a great company, been built through acquisitions over more than half a century, but they didn't really have a viable path to digital. They were trying mm-hmm. a bunch of things. None of them worked out particularly well. So we both had a strategic need to come together. And also, frankly, from an AOL standpoint, representing our shareholders, we recognized there was some value in diversification. Our stock had run up quite significantly, and owning a share of a business that had a more diversified mix of things would make sense. So I did approach Jerry Levin, who was the CEO of Time Warner at the time, and basically said, strategically, I think it makes a lot of sense. If we put these companies together, we have an opportunity to really kind of lead in the future and in a lot of different ways, streaming and so forth. And within the first minute or two of my little pitch, I said, I'd be willing to step aside as CEO to allow you to be CEO of the combined company because I believe in this idea. And that's what happened. Eventually, it took us a little while to put a deal together, but we didn't finally, it took a little while to get it approved, but finally it did get approved and I did step down as CEO.
So there's a theme I keep noticing in lots of the things you've done, whether it was AOL or the Time Warner merger, and we'll talk about Revolution in a bit, but everything you seem to do seems to be both innovative and highly disruptive. Is this by design, or is that just a happy accident?
Well, you kind of say that. I like to, and like a lot of entrepreneurs do, pick battles worth fighting, kind of mountains worth climbing. You know, mm-hmm. I don't, you know, if it's easy, it's not that interesting. And,
right.
And in fact, what I get motivated by it. Again, this is true with many entrepreneurs. If somebody says it can't be done, it's like, okay, well, you know, game on. We're going to
hold my beer.
Yeah. In the early days of the internet, people said it can't be done. The internet was never going to be a mainstream phenomenon. A decade ago, when we started working on Rise the Rest and said innovation is going to happen all over the country, not just in Silicon Valley, most people thought it was kind of laughable. They didn't think that was really likely to happen. Now, thankfully, some of those views are changing. But I think picking those challenges that really, I think, have a positive impact in the world, and even though they are hard and in most cases, maybe in all cases, take 10, 20 years to achieve your goal, those are the battles I like fighting.
Really quite intriguing. So let's talk about Revolution. What is it? How did it begin? When did it start?
Well, it began a few years after I stepped down as CEO of AOL, and I was trying to figure out what my next act was going to be. And rather than start a company again, I thought I'd start an investment firm that could back the next generation of entrepreneurs. Initially, it was started in 2005, and it was called Revolution, but it was just my capital. A little over a decade ago, we decided to open it up to outside capital. So we have institutional investors across the platform now. We have kind of three basic groups. One is Revolution Growth, which is our later stage fund. We also have Revolution Ventures. And more recently, about 5 years ago, we launched the Rise of the Rest Seed Fund. So now we're able to back entrepreneurs at every stage of their journey, whether it's really just a really early stage where they just need seed funding, whether it's that next phase where they're starting to grow and need venture funding, or if they're really starting to scale and need growth funding. That's really what Revolution is about. And the other two things that make it, I think, interesting versus maybe other firms in the country, and we talked about a little bit earlier, but because we're based in Washington, D.C., and because we've been working on policy issues for nearly four decades, we think the next wave of innovation policy is going to be front and center. And in Revolution, we're trying to position as the leading investment firm in the country that's focused on policy. And the second is, I think we've been unusually focused on place with Rise of the Rest. We've now made 200 investments in 100 different cities. We've done these bus tours all across the country. And even the reason I wrote the book on Rise of the Rest is there's remarkable things happening all over the country, remarkable new companies being built, cities being renewed and revitalized, but most people aren't paying attention to it, and I really wanted to tell those stories, and that's been a growing focus of Revolution. So it's an investment firm with outside investors at the seed, venture, and growth stage, but with particular focus on policy and on place.
And we're going to talk about place in a moment, but just to put this in a little context, Revolution has already had some big successes. Sweetgreen's, obviously a big hit. DraftKings, another one. Do those date back to when it was a family office, or was that seed or venture type investments?
Those were both growth stage investments.
So we
were
the
first institutional investors in Sweetgreen probably 7 or 8 years ago. DraftKings probably 5 or 6 years ago. Also Clear, the biometric company.
Love them. Just flew out of JFK. They're the best.
Yeah, recently, a company in Chicago called Tempus has got a big data precision medicine to help people who are diagnosed with cancer.
So you're DC-based, which has to give you a slightly different perspective from the folks in Silicon Valley. Before we start talking about the rest of the country, what advantages do you find being at the heart of the policymaking apparatus of the United States?
Well, our office, the Revolution Office, is a few blocks from the White House, not too far from the Capitol. And just having lived there now for a few decades and having a number of people involved in the firm who have been steeped in policy work for government. One of the co-founders of Revolution 15 years ago is Ron Klain, who's now President mm-hmm. Biden's chief of staff. John Delaney joined us more recently, started two companies, went public, then was in Congress and ran for president. So we've got some people that really understand policy, and we've got a location that I think is interesting. And as I said, if you think about the way I look at the internet, is the first wave was getting everybody online. We talked about those early days mm-hmm. of AOL. Went from an idea that nobody cared about to suddenly everybody needed to be connected. And you had to build those on-ramps, build all those servers out, build all that infrastructure. And that was the first 20 years or so. The last 20 years has really been the second wave, which has been about building on top of the internet, building apps and software and services on top of the internet, Facebook, Google, things like that. The third wave is when the internet meets the real world. Mm-hmm. And that means you're starting to deal with some of the most important aspects of our lives. How do we stay healthy? What do we eat? How do we learn? How do we invest? How do we move around in terms of transportation? And what's interesting about those businesses is they tend to be regulated. Because they're so important, there tends to be public policy focus on those. So innovators need to understand it's a little bit different as in this third wave, and that understanding the policy framework, both in terms of a go-to-market strategy and also what policies could get changed to open up new opportunities. That some of the healthcare legislation passed more than a decade ago that opened up things like Medicare Advantage, that created enormous investment opportunities. More recently, just this summer, there was legislation including around climate that's going to create enormous opportunities to invest in that sector. We saw one of our companies, DraftKings, that we talked about earlier, there was a change, actually a Supreme Court ruling mm-hmm. that allowed states to make different rules around essentially betting. That opened up a big opportunity and actually accelerated the growth of DraftKings. So policy can be a strategic advantage for companies in this third wave, and being in Washington, D.C. and having that connectivity, I think that perspective and a lot of relationships with people on both sides of the aisle, I think gives Revolution a unique platform, and we're able to help the entrepreneurs read back in ways that other venture capitalists typically can't.
So you grow up in Hawaii, you end up relocating to DC. What led to the idea, hey, there's a massive amount of innovation and energy and entrepreneurship in between New York and Silicon Valley? How did you find your way to saying, let's figure out a way to reach these folks, get them funded, and give them a boost to launch their businesses?
Well, the triggering event, I was asked a little over a decade ago to chair a White House initiative called Startup America Partnership that was launched by President Obama. And that got me traveling around the country because it was really trying to promote regional entrepreneurship. This is at a time when unemployment was high, and there was a recognition that one way to deal with that was to create new jobs, and one way to create new jobs was to create new companies. Mm-hmm. And so that led to a focus on regional entrepreneurship. And as I traveled more and looked at more of the data, I found it surprising, almost shocking, that even though these new companies are the major job creator, most of the venture capital to back these new companies is just in a few places. Right. 75% of venture capital over the last decade has gone to just three states, California, New York, and Massachusetts. Right. So it doesn't
even
really,
worse than three states. It's really three cities. It's San Francisco, New York, and Boston.
Yeah, within those states, it's overwhelmingly three cities, as you said. So as a result, a lot of people in different parts of the country have felt like they have to be there. If they mm-hmm. if they're not there, they really don't have a shot at raising the capital they need to start or scale a company. That's led to sort of a brain drain in lots of parts of the country where people kind of leave. And how do you slow that brain drain? How do you create a boomerang of people returning? How do you create more jobs in these communities all around the country, so there is more hope and around the future? And so that really led to launching about 8 years ago Rise the Rest, which initially started as bus tours. We went to places like Detroit and Pittsburgh, and then we went, you know, Minneapolis, Denver, you know, kind of, you know, 44 cities so far, really all over the country, to see firsthand what was happening there. We did this with a big red bus that got a lot of attention. We did pitch competitions. We invited in each city. We invited people to join us. And that gave us another, you know, kind of lens into what was happening. And then we really doubled down about 5 years ago when we launched the Rise the Rest seed fund. And we decided to do things a little differently there. Rather than the first few years, it was just my capital. But we decided to, you know, kind of ask some of the most prominent entrepreneurs and investors in the country to join us as LPs in this fund. And so we have about 35 people, entrepreneurs like Jeff Bezos and Howard Schultz and Tory Burch and Sarah Blakely and venture capitalists like John Doerr and Jim Breyer and private equity investors like Henry Kravis and David Rubenstein, hedge fund people like, you know, Ray Dalio, really an amazing group of—
That's a murderer's row right
there.
It's
an amazing group of people. We're honored to have them as our partners in this. And we set out to find these entrepreneurs, and we said we're going to try to build, you know, a fund that really can generate, you know, top-tier returns, which is the best way to drive more capital from the coast to other parts of the country. And it's working. And the reason to write the book is to really tell those stories and really kind of put some, you know, a spotlight on some of these cities that are showing remarkable momentum and some of these entrepreneurs in those cities that we call the, you know, sort of surprising places. That it's not Silicon Valley, it's not New York, and it's not Boston. It's Richmond, Virginia, where a company like TemperPack is really innovative in sustainable packaging, or Chattanooga, where a company FreightWaves is doing some interesting things. Interesting, we're in the Bloomberg, you know, offices today for this. So they're building essentially a Bloomberg data platform for the trucking and logistics industry because some of the biggest trucking companies are based in Chattanooga, or a company in Indianapolis called 120 Water that's focused on, you know, helping initially consumers, but then cities, you know, kind of, you know, test their water to make sure that after the Flint water crisis, there was a lot of concern about that. Or in Baltimore, Maryland's company Catalyte using AI to identify undiscovered kind of talent that people have for coding. And some of the people who have gone through this program end up making two or three times more than they had before. I remember one UPS truck driver, nobody when he was growing up told him he could be a coder. Catalyte, you know, determined he had a talent for coding, and so he's making substantially more than he was making before. So these are the kind of stories we're seeing all across the country and cities that would surprise you. And I think it's a, you know, the reason to write the book is I wanted to tell those stories. I think most people reading the book will be surprised by the stories, surprised by the companies, surprised by the cities, and have a, you know, have a slightly more optimistic view of the future of America because of what's bubbling all across the country.
So tell us a little bit about what these bus tours are like when this big red coach rolls into a small town and says, okay, we're going to hold a bake-off for the best startup, technology, whatever it happens to be. What is that like? And what is the reaction of the locals like to this?
No, it's very positive. I think for them, it's a signal that somebody's paying attention, a signal that things are, you know, turning up in terms of new possibilities. And we use the bus. It's partly a visual. You know,
for sure, a giant red coach.
It gets people's attention. And, you know, I remember a few years ago, 60 Minutes, it's a story on it. I think that the optics of that, you know, sort of the Americana road trip bus dynamics is part of it. But there's a more strategic reason for it. So we actually use the bus as a rolling convening platform. We bring people together from different parts of the, you know, the community. The mayor often joined us, or a senator, or the university president, or CEOs of big companies, as well as obviously the entrepreneurs starting these new companies. And we're trying to connect people and create more of a collaborative startup community there. And we also invite people from other places to join us, either investors from the coast or people from larger companies to join us on the bus, so they can see firsthand what's happening, as well as obviously inviting media, both local media and national media. And it's our way to learn what's happening, identify promising companies to invest in, but also to try to showcase the best of what each of these cities, and in the process, if you take a step back, showcase the best of America, not just what's happening on the coast, but what's happening all across the country.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
I would think that with all the focus on New York, Boston, and especially Silicon Valley, there are some enormous inefficiencies and lots of great ideas and either underfunded or undervalued startups in the heartland are being neglected until you shined a light on them.
Yeah, and it's we still have a lot of work to do, but it's starting to change. I think in the last few years, people have seen some real significant successes. Even a company I write about in the book called MailChimp, based in Atlanta, mm-hmm. got acquired for $12 billion. It was actually bootstrapped. There was no venture capital, in part because they weren't able to raise venture capital when
Amazing.
They started more than a decade ago in Atlanta, because most people weren't really investing in cities like Atlanta. As investors see more and more of those success stories in places all across the country, it's opened their eyes to the potential, and they're starting to pay more attention. They're still overwhelmingly investing in their own backyards. If they're sitting in San Francisco, most of their investments are in Silicon Valley, but at least they're a little more open-minded about it. And frankly, the pandemic has been helpful in that.
Sure.
I don't want to make light of all the tragedies of the pandemic, but
no,
it's a silver lining.
Forced people to think outside of, listen, if you're stuck at home, and you're talking to an entrepreneur, it doesn't matter if they're down the street or 3,000 miles away.
Exactly. If you're doing a pitch meeting on Zoom, what difference does it make where they are? That was helpful. The other thing that's been helpful is for a lot of people, the pandemic was sort of a opportunity to take a step back and reassess their lives. And some people have decided to shift how they live and how they work and where they live and where they work. And the whole idea of more remote work, hybrid work has become a real phenomenon. And that is helping these Rise of the Rest cities. That we've seen some people who grew up in different parts of the country or went to college in different parts of the country and had gone to the coast, typically Silicon Valley, decided during the pandemic to move back. And once they're there, even though they usually start continuing to work for the company they had been working for, just doing it remotely, they realize there's remarkable things happening in the startup communities in those cities. And some of them are now starting to leave those big companies to join some of those small companies. Some of them even starting to think about starting their own companies in these communities. So I think the tipping point for the Rise of the Rest really was the pandemic. And we'll see an acceleration over the next decade. And it goes back to what I said earlier. But for me, these journeys, these battles I'm fighting, whether it be the early days of the internet or more recently leveling the playing field with Rise of the Rest, have a certain dynamic to them, which is the first 10 years it's a slog, and the second 10 years things really kind of take off. We saw that with the internet. We're beginning to see glimmers of that with Rise of the Rest, and hopefully this book will help accelerate the whole movement.
So let's talk about some of the cities that you've gone to. After New York, Boston, and Silicon Valley, what is the next largest tier? What do you think is the fastest growing cities? And what cities surprised you the most for whatever reason it happened to occur?
It's a tough question for two reasons. One is it's not just a few cities, it's a few dozen
cities.
The rise. So it's hard to just pick a few. And the second is a little bit like asking a parent who their favorite child is. You know,
we all know.
I love all my children and I love all these cities.
That's what you say, but we know you have a favorite. But so let me ask the easier question. What surprised you the most when you were out and about in 100 different cities?
Well, each of the cities, there's some things that are similar and some things are different. What's similar is what's happened is in the last particularly decade, more attention got focused on startups. Even the government leaders, mayors and governors, for decades, economic development was basically getting a big company to move their headquarters or a big company to open a factory. And the recognition more recently was, no, the real way to do that in a sustainable, efficient way is actually to launch new companies, some of which would fail, because that's the nature of startups, but some of which would succeed and be maybe the Fortune 500 companies of tomorrow. And then kind of creating more of that collaboration in the community, more of that sense of possibility in the community has been a really key ingredient that we've been watching building over the past decade. But the other aspect I think is interesting is there are some cities that really, it's not just a lower cost of living or lower cost of operations, which is a motivator for some, or family reasons or lifestyle reasons to be in a particular city, which is the motivator for some. There are more and more cities where there really is an advantage to be in those cities versus being in, say, San Francisco or New York. Take healthcare. The healthcare really is going to require systems level change to really revolutionize how we think about our health. That's going to require partnerships. Some of the key partners you need in the healthcare space are big hospitals like Mayo Clinic in Minnesota, or Cleveland Clinic in Ohio, or Johns Hopkins in Maryland, or MD Anderson in Texas. Being closer to them probably increases your odds of establishing partnerships with them. So that dynamic is critical. Another example is a company we backed in Northwest Arkansas, Fayetteville, called Acre Trader. Basically, it's a platform to invest in farmland. Mm-hmm. And the founder, Carter Molloy, actually was in San Francisco and said, if I'm going to start a company that's going to basically be this platform for farmland, I should be where the farmers are. That's a good way to build kind of trust and scale up the platform. And he's done very well. They've now raised a large round and are scaling quite rapidly.
I am familiar with Acre Trader and had no idea that you guys had anything to do with that.
And it's a wonderful Ride the Rest story because, again, even though Carter Molloy had left that area to go to San Francisco, he returned. And some of that, I'm sure, was for family reasons, but most of it was for strategic reasons. Acre Trader is more successful in Arkansas than if it had been stayed in California or New York. And we're seeing that happen in more and more of these cities. But in terms of the one city I would point out, because it's an amazing story, it's even I lead off the book with it, is the story of Detroit. Mm-hmm. People don't really focus on this, but if you think about it, Detroit 100 years ago essentially was Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. It was the most innovative city in the country when the automobile was the hot technology of the day. 100 years ago, Silicon Valley was fruit orchards. They weren't growing startups. They were growing fruit.
Apple is called Apple for a reason.
And so, Detroit was rocking and rolling. The car revolution for a couple decades. People wanted to be part of that, moved to Detroit. Houses were being built. Schools were being built. Detroit was really rocking and rolling. And then, about 50 years ago, things turned. And they lost 60% of their population.
Wow.
60%. And the year before we rolled in with our Rise of the Rest bus, the city of Detroit went bankrupt. What had been Silicon Valley went bankrupt. That's the bad news. Mm-hmm. The good news is a vibrant startup culture, particularly in the downtown Detroit area. We back companies like Shinola and StockX mm-hmm. and others that are in Detroit with the backing of a great entrepreneur, Dan Gilbert, a strong mayor, foundations like Kresge, all work together to say we need to rebuild Detroit and we're going to do it on the back of backing new companies, startups in Detroit. So now Detroit's kind of back on the rise and doing some phenomenal things. The other city we visited on that first Rise the Rest bus tour was Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. Think about Pittsburgh. It really powered the Industrial Revolution. It was the steel capital. And 100 years ago, it was rocking and rolling and then lost some of that lead, but reinvented itself in the last couple of decades. They have a great university there, Carnegie Mellon, and big focus on robotics, for example. And as a result of backing new companies and startups like Duolingo, the language app, spun out of Carnegie Mellon, started in Pittsburgh, it's seeing the rise again. But this is really the story of dozens of cities. I think if you fast forward 10 or 20 years, it's a more, as I said earlier, a more optimistic view of America that will have a more inclusive innovation economy. It won't just be a few people in a few places. It will be a much more broader-based innovation economy, which I think will result in the creation of more jobs in more parts of the country, which might even create more of a of an opportunity to knit together a very divided country that's obviously divided in many respects. But one way is sort of this opportunity gap. There are some people doing really well, a lot of people struggling and feeling left behind. How do we create some of the jobs of the future, even some of the industries of the future in these cities all across America?
You raise an interesting policy question. Whenever I see, you know, a groundbreaking where some giant company comes in with all these tax abatements, we saw it with Foxconn in Wisconsin, turned out to be a bust. We see it every time some billionaire's stadium gets paid for by taxpayers. The math never seems to work out. But it sounds like what you're saying here is, if we stop trying to do these giant, let's bring a big company in to save the factory town, and if that company leaves, the town is toast, let's create an entire different model of startups, small companies, build that whole ecosystem that has a much better chance of success for that region. Is that a fair way to
say it? For that region and success for the country. The interesting thing about this economic development battle where different states are fighting with each other over the same, you know, existing companies, is it sort of zero sum for America.
Right.
You know,
right.
They're just throwing money at it to get, you know, to leave here to go there. It doesn't really help the country. And so, and as you say, often those investments do not pay off for those particular cities or those particular, you know, states. So it's way better to focus on the new companies. And we saw an interesting dynamic a few years ago when Amazon launched its second headquarters, you know, effort. And they basically said, we're going to create a second headquarters and create tens of thousands of jobs in that second headquarters. And, you know, let us know if you're interested in us, you know, coming. And 230 different cities all pitched to get Amazon to, you know, to come. Ultimately decided, actually, in Northern Virginia, not too far from where we started AOL, is where they decided to kind of plant their flag. But then, you know, the nice thing about it was those 230 cities had to come together, had to make a joint pitch, had to figure out what their strengths were to really highlight, what some of the weaknesses were that they could focus on. And what we're seeing is sort of a continuing effect of that, that many of these cities, you know, are now focused on these new companies, focused on backing, you know, the startups, saying, you know, we don't really want to do that, fighting again to get Amazon. How do we create the next Amazon in our own community? So that's resulting in a pivot to focus on new companies, on startups in cities all across America.
So let's dig a little deeper into Revolution. First is there a favorite sector or industry or size that Revolution likes, or it doesn't matter? If it's an interesting idea with a chance for success, it interests you.
Well, as I said, there's two key planks of our strategy. One is policy and the other is place. So on the policy side, we tend to focus on the industries where there is a policy, you know, kind of component. And so I mentioned a health tech company called Tempus. I mentioned TemperPak, which is in the sustainable, you know, kind of packaging business, Clear, the biometric, you know, company. Those are their policy issues and usually partner issues associated with that.
But agriculture also is something else.
Agriculture would fit into that. Sports tech would fit into that. So there are many sectors that fit into that, but they generally, most of the theme that generally drives most of our efforts are around you know, policy. And then, of course, with our Ride the Rest seed fund, that is very place-based and it's sector agnostic. And one of the interesting things we learned late last year, we did a joint report with PitchBook, and there are two data points that I thought were striking and even surprising to me, and I've been working on this for a decade. The first was, in the last decade, 1,400 new regional venture firms were started up, 1,400. And they're typically focusing in that early seed and kind of, you know, venture stage. And the other data point was there's a 600% increase in venture capital going to these Ride the Rest cities. So the things we've been talking about over the decade, we're starting to see progress, new venture firms starting, more capital, you know, flowing. But we think things will really accelerate in the next decade. We're just trying to make sure at Revolution we're positioned to really be the leader around you know, place and use even the book to make the case for why other investors should be investing in these other cities, not just in the usual places like San Francisco and New York and Boston.
So Revolution brings a lot more to the table than just capital. There's a lot of value add coming.
Absolutely. No, the beginning, we make an investment. That's the start of the process of working with a company, whether it be introducing them to new partnerships or helping them recruit people, their management team or their boards, or helping them navigate sometimes complicated, you know, policy issues. There's lots of things we try to do to really help these companies scale, help them achieve their full potential.
Quite intriguing. Coming up, we continue our conversation with Steve Case, Chair and CEO of Revolution, discussing his new book, The Rise of the Rest, How Entrepreneurs in Surprising Places Are Building the New American Dream. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My extra special guest this week is Steve Case. He is the chairman and CEO of Revolution, as well as one of the three co-founders of America Online. He is also chair of the Case Foundation and the Smithsonian. He is the author of a new book, The Rise of the Rest, How Entrepreneurs in Surprising Places Are Building the New American Dream. That is out this week. So let's talk about the book. What motivates you, as someone who's written a book? I know how much work goes into it. What motivated you to sit down and say, yeah, I'm going to put all this down on paper?
I thought I had to write the book. I spent most of the decade traveling the country, meeting entrepreneurs, visiting dozens of cities, seeing remarkable things happening that were most people are unaware of. And so I just felt like I didn't have a choice. I had to write this book. I had to tell these stories. I had to profile some of these entrepreneurs, talk about what they're doing with their companies, showcase some of these rising cities in terms of what they're doing to really create, you know, kind of a renew their communities, create more opportunity, more jobs, things like that. So it was not really a choice. I just felt compelled to write this, you know, this book.
What was the response from the various entrepreneurs when you say to somebody, hey, I'm going to feature you as a chapter in this new book? Are people excited about it?
Of course. I think they, particularly the entrepreneurs in these Rise of the Rest cities, tend to feel lonely, a little left out. They don't have the, at least, yeah, we're working on this, obviously, but don't have quite the attention that you have if you're an entrepreneur in a place like Silicon Valley. So even when we've rolled into town with our Rise of the Rest bus, and have pitch competitions where entrepreneurs can be on stage, that allows them to talk up what they're doing and get people in their communities to better understand what they're doing and believe in what they're doing. And similarly with the book, everybody we talked to was honored, obviously, to be included in the book and appreciative of the fact that we're really championing their stories, trying to do what we can to help them scale into being kind of significant companies that can change the world, create significant value for the investors, create, you know, hopefully thousands of jobs, and the process kind of lift up their particular communities and strengthen America in terms of having a more inclusive economy.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Tell us about these pitch competitions. How long does each entrepreneur get? What are they allowed to bring? What are some of those pitches like? How do they vary from one to one?
Well, when we decided to do a road trip, we planned this for more than 6 months in advance. So we have an advanced team that's going to the cities. We try to understand who should we visit in the cities, what startup to do, like a bus startup crawl with the, and then we invite and have a lunch and pitch and event, a lot of different things to really kind of get people together. But for the pitch competition specifically, we basically say we're coming to town, we're doing this pitch competition, and we generally get about 100 people applying to pitch, and then our team sorts through that and picks the best 8 or 10 to be on stage. Then we actually hire a pitch coach to help them work on their pitch, because
really?
We really want to help them, whether they win or not. We're trying to help them be positioned for a success. So they each get 3 minutes or so to pitch, and then a couple minutes of questions following that. And then the judges spend some time reviewing which ones should win, and then we make a decision on which one we're going to invest in. Sometimes we actually invest in more than one because we're just struck by the power of some of those ideas.
So just a quick digression. So we have a VC fund that just focuses on financial technology because of my day job, and we just had this giant conference out in, of all places, Huntington Beach. In SoCal, and one of the things we did was a pitch competition. It was 5 minutes per entrepreneur, and I think we ended up going with 10 people out of well over 100 applications. But the idea of a pitch coach, because some of the pitches were fantastic, some were a little rough around the edges, the idea of a pitch coach is really intriguing. How did people respond to that? Someone coming in and saying, hey, you only have 3 or 4 minutes. Here's what you need to focus on.
It was super helpful. And obviously these companies have been done pitches before, but they've never done, in most cases, pitch at this state, kind of level with this kind of audience. And so it actually came to us, we had a partnership with Google. They have an initiative called Google for Startups. And we were doing some joint things with them, and they were doing a pitch competition where they invited some of the entrepreneurs that we helped select from all around the country to come pitch at Google headquarters in Silicon Valley. And as part of that, they used a pitch coach. So we then embraced that idea, and ever since we've had a pitch coach as well. But no, can really result in the entrepreneur is telling a much more compelling story, and it benefits them long after we leave town. They have a crisper, more compelling pitch for the next time they're meeting with a prospective investor or customer or partner.
Data is wonderful, but sometimes it's all about the narrative, isn't it?
Exactly. No, storytelling is a lot of what this is about. You have to captivate people, and everybody has to be selling. If you're trying to hire somebody, you're selling. If you're trying to get investors, you're selling. If you're trying to get media attention, you're selling. If you're obviously you're trying to get customers, you're selling. And everybody can be coached to be better at what they're trying to to sell.
Huh, really interesting. You said something earlier that I let sneak by, but I got to bring it back up. The Jobs Act passed under the Obama administration and the Investing Opportunities Act, not only were you involved in helping to create that policy, you were instrumental in getting that passed. So first, tell us a little bit about that experience. And second, what has that meant for startups and funding of new companies and entrepreneurs?
Well, the Jobs Act passed just about a decade ago. It had broad bipartisan support. It's called the Jumpstarting Our Business Startups Act. And it was basically updating the rules of securities laws that had been in place since 1933. So this wasn't just pre-internet. This is pre-television. It needed a little bit of an update. And it allowed things like crowdfunding. It created an on-ramp for young companies to go public, what are called emerging growth companies, that fueled more IPOs. It was really about giving more entrepreneurs more access to capital, whether it be the early stage or or the later stage, with the goal of having more companies start and scale and create more jobs. And so that's really why it was called the Jobs Act. And it was great. I worked on President Obama's Jobs and Competitiveness Council, and there was a little subcommittee focused particularly on entrepreneurship. I worked with Sheryl Sandberg at Facebook and John Doerr at the venture capitalist Kleiner Perkins to help figure out what some of the policies would be that would create a more fertile startup environment all across the country. And the Jobs Act was part of that.
So what do you think the direct result of that legislation and that policy update has been in the decade you've been traveling around the country and looking at startups?
I think crowdfunding has been helpful to a number of companies that otherwise wouldn't have had access to capital, would never have gotten started up. And there are more companies that have gone public in the last decade because of the Jobs Act, making it a little easier for these emerging companies to go public.
I keep finding these when I'm searching for something. I keep finding these funny little products like, oh, that looks really interesting. I've never seen anything like that. You click through, and as often as not, it's a crowdfunding, hey, give us enough money to help get this product launched, and you get a product, but not necessarily any equity ownership. Is that the future for very specialized niche products as opposed to broad company startups?
Yeah, the crowdfunding really started with some platforms like Kickstarter, where
right.
exactly what you're saying, that if people offer a particular product, usually before it had even been manufactured, and get right. some pre-orders that would allow them to have the capital to then go build out the product. And that worked for a number of companies. Some of those products then ended up getting launched more broadly, or they ended up raising capital more broadly. But there also has been more and more companies that are using crowdfunding to raise equity capital to help fund the companies as
you
well.
You can do both,
yeah.
Not just a product, but
exactly.
you're actually a small investor in a startup.
Exactly.
Huh. Really, really quite quite fascinating. So let's circle back to 2000. The Time Warner AOL deal goes through. You set up a family office. And from that, you really start to expand into a lot of different public service and philanthropy. You mentioned the National Advisory Council on Innovation and Entrepreneurship, as well as President Obama's Council on Jobs and Competitiveness. Tell us a little bit about when you go from a nimble startup to a big merger to the government, what's the trade-off? How difficult is it to move the ball down the field?
Well, I think it's difficult for sure, which is why I do it only on the side. It's sort of my moonlighting, my side hustle. My main event is focused on investing
Steve
in companies
K's side
through Revolution. But I do think it's important to make sure that, I do at least everything I can to make sure America remains the most innovative entrepreneurial nation. I do think it's important to try to, as we discussed around Rise the Rest, create a more inclusive innovation economy that brings along more people and more places. And while most of that and most of my time is spent on working with those entrepreneurs as an investor and mentor, I do think it's important to make sure we have the right policy framework in place that creates as much opportunity as possible for as many entrepreneurs as possible, as many places in America as possible. So that led to the work around the National Advisory Council on Innovation and Entrepreneurship more than a decade ago. Actually, the current Secretary of Commerce, Gina Raimondo, restarted it recently, asked me to co-chair it again. So I agreed to do that. And we're focused particularly on identifying some of the industries of the future where America really needs to lead and supporting this effort around regional hubs, including some of the legislation that passed recently to fund more regional innovation around the country. So it is less Silicon Valley.
What's the big change in the decade that has ensued from the last time you were involved with this policy or this panel to today?
Well, some of the initial focus was on this access to capital side, which led to things like the Jobs Act. Now it's, I think, a little more focused on access to opportunity, which ties in with the work we're doing around Rise the Rest. How do you create a level the playing field so everybody everywhere has a shot at the American dream? That's really what it's all about, and trying to create more of that investment. It's striking to me because I've been doing this now for a while. As you think about that early days of the internet, we talked about AOL being in Northern Virginia outside of Washington, D.C. Actually, a number of the companies that were pivotal in that first wave were all across the country. It was mm-hmm. not so much about Silicon Valley. For example, IBM's PC operations were in Boca Raton, Florida. CompuServe, a major online service at the time, sure. was in Columbus, Ohio. Hayes, the communications modem company, was in Atlanta, Georgia. Sprint, another communications company, was in you know, Kansas City. Dell was in Austin. Microsoft actually started in Albuquerque before moving to Seattle. So that first wave of innovation in the internet was regionally distributed. It was only the second wave when it became about, you know, software that Silicon Valley rose to prominence. I think in the third wave, we can redistribute again and have innovation in different parts of the country. And that's part of the focus on the policy side. Just do what I can to bring that entrepreneurial lens, that investor lens to policymakers, do it in a very, you know, kind of bipartisan, you know, kind of way, working with Republicans and Democrats, trying to figure out what is the right, you know, kind of policy going forward. It's easier to do for, you know, for, based on your question, you know, it's challenging to deal with these things. Sometimes it does feel like you're trying to, you know, move a mountain, but doing it, you know, occasionally on the side, it works for me. I have great respect for the people who are willing to jump in and do it full time. I think that's not my thing.
It's tough. You mentioned the Subcommittee on Entrepreneurship. Tell us a little bit about their work and what have they accomplished?
Well, that was, I think, pivotal in terms of, you know, creating the framework and also the momentum around things like the Jobs Act. And the way we did that is we actually asked an outside consulting firm, it was a McKinsey, to look at all of the ideas that have been put on the table, legislation that had been introduced in Congress, think tanks and others that would create a more entrepreneurial ecosystem all across the country. And a number of things were identified, and we just kind of whacked away working on identifying which policy would have the biggest impact. And I think we did make progress in lots of different areas. One area we did, you know, recommend that we spend more time on that we didn't make progress on, but hopefully still will be immigration reform. Mm-hmm. How do we make sure we remain a magnet for people all around the world who want to come here and start companies here and create jobs here? And how do we make it a little easier for people to come and people who come for universities, you know, education, how a little easier for them to stay? So, you know, we can continue to lead the charge and continue to be that, you know, that win what's now a global battle for talent. So that's one area that was a strong recommendation of the Jobs Council a decade ago that has not yet happened, but hopefully will in the future.
In the U.S., there's a labor shortage at just about every level of the employment spectrum, entry level work, farm work, all the way up to very senior technology people. What can we do to bring in the best and the brightest from the rest of the world?
Well, we've got to pass legislation. It came close this summer. There's some legislation called the Startup Visa that essentially would make it easier for entrepreneurs who are going to...
Did that go anywhere?
It did not get done. It was part of some broader, you know, legislation, but ultimately did not get done. And I recognize that immigration is complicated and really emotional and become very political because there are various facets of immigration, securing the border, things like that. But on the specific issue of how do we, you know, get people from all around the world who have ideas and want to start companies, how do we make sure those companies are started here and the jobs, you know, therefore are created here as opposed to created, you know, elsewhere. And we have seen in the last, you know, couple of decades a globalization of innovation and a globalization of venture capital. 25, 30 years ago, over 90% of global venture capital was invested in the United States. Now it's under 50%.
Wow.
So other countries have figured out that sort of the secret sauce that sort of powered the American story is entrepreneurship, and venture capital is part of that. And I even in this new book on Rise of Rest talk about the need to focus on immigration reform, focus on backing founders from all over the world and starting those companies in the United States. But obviously the key message is they don't have to be in Silicon Valley or New York or Boston. They could be in many other cities around the country, and that's what we're trying to promote.
Let's talk a little bit about some of your philanthropic work. You joined the Giving Pledge in 2010. Tell us what that experience was like. I've heard some pretty amusing stories about working with Bill Gates and that process.
Well, I've obviously known Bill Gates for decades. We were vigorous competitors in the late 90s when I was running AOL. But it was great to become partners around, you know, things around philanthropy, including the Giving Pledge and Melinda Gates and also Warren Buffett. I've known for quite some time. And so when they approached my wife Jean and I when they were getting this started, it was over a decade ago, we were initially a little reluctant to be that public about what we were doing philanthropically. We'd always done things in a somewhat, you know, quieter way. But we decided to join because we thought maybe it would lead others to making a commitment to giving the majority of their wealth away. But also, we thought we could learn from others and learn how to be smarter about the philanthropic investments we made. And I think that's been the case. There have been a number of meetings of the giving pledgers on specific topics, and also kind of annual meetings. And I think everybody that's part of the giving pledge is a little bit wiser because of the network that's been created among the people who made that commitment.
So let's talk a little bit about the metrics of giving. Go back 20, 30 years, and the question was sort of like advertising. You know, some of it's effective, you just don't know which half is. How do you think about tracking, analyzing, and determining if you're moving the needle when you're making a specific donation?
Well, first of all, I should say my wife, Jean, has led the Case Foundation since we started it 25 years ago. I've been focusing more on the investment side. She's been focusing more on the philanthropic side. So she gets all the credit. But I think we and others have gotten much more precise in terms of trying to understand the impact of the philanthropic investments we're making. What are the key metrics that should be tracked there? And specifically Jean, leading the foundation, has brought a little bit of that venture capital mentality to it. That rather than just pick one thing you invest in, we pick several things and cycle them through at various times. Right now, a primary focus of Jean is around National Geographic Society, which she is the chair of. I've spent time as the chair of the Smithsonian Institution, including how to move it into more of a digital future. So those are a couple of the areas of focus. But we found that you can bring some of your business experience to the philanthropic sector. You just have to recognize it's different. But one thing that is similar across both of them is the value of partnerships. There's an African proverb we both love, that if you want to go quickly, you can go alone, but if you want to go far, you must go together. So a lot of what we do with the philanthropic efforts are around building partnerships. A lot of what we do with Revolution and also Rise the Rest is around building partnerships. So that idea of collaboration and going far together is one of the constants across all our work.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline, it's teamwork, and it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle-market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Huh. So you mentioned the Smithsonian. I'm a fan. The Smithsonian Institution is the world's largest museum and research complex. What led you to that? Is there any particular interest in science, history, technology? How did you get involved with them?
I was asked over a decade ago to join what they call the Board of Regents, and then more recently became the chair of it. And I, like many people, have seen the wonders of the Smithsonian. I remember even when I was 18, I came to Washington and saw the Smithsonian for the first time and experienced some of the wonders of it, and was inspired to do a number of different things because of it. So I wanted to make a contribution to kind of take the Smithsonian into the future, build on its legacy over 175 years wow. around increasing and diffusing knowledge, and add to it a digital component that, you know, we've been working on what we call the virtual Smithsonian, where rather than just assume that you're going to fly to Washington, D.C., visit the National Mall, and visit our 19 museums, we want to come to you. And so we want the Smithsonian to be in every home and every classroom and embracing a lot of partnerships, embracing a lot of technologies to do that.
Spirit of St. Louis is hanging in Smithsonian.
Still there.
That's my vivid recollection as a kid going through it, and it's just stayed with me for forever.
And we have, as you probably know, we have two air and space museums, one on the National Mall, one out mm-hmm. by Dulles Airport. The one at National Mall has been closed for most of the past year. It's under reconstruction. It was opened in 1976, and we're going to reopen it actually next month. Part of it is being reimagined to be the Bezos Learning Center. The largest philanthropic gift in the Smithsonian's history is from Jeff Bezos, a $200 million gift to the Smithsonian to build out that Air and Space Museum.
Really, really quite fascinating. You mentioned partnerships. What did you bring from your AOL experience to philanthropy? How much of that foundational, you know, building a business, ramping it up, taking it public, merging it, how does that apply to a very different part of the world?
Well, again, my wife Jean gets, you know, been taking the lead here, but from my prism, it's how do you identify problems that need to be solved, and then bring both an entrepreneurial perspective in terms of what new things might get started, as well as a kind of almost like growth investing perspective, what existing organizations might get scaled. And we've done work on both sides, made investments to scale up existing organizations like Habitat for Humanity or Special Olympics, which we were at the time, I think, the largest kind of givers to. This goes back a couple of decades, as well as launching some initiatives ourselves, including a digital divide initiative over 20 years ago to try to get computer technology centers installed in different neighborhoods and that didn't otherwise have access to it, with partnerships with a lot of people that made that possible. So it's a mix of identifying some of these problems that need to be solved and figuring out. Some of them are kind of like using the investing mentality, or things we make seed investments in to get them started. But some of them also are backing existing organizations and giving them the growth level investment to really scale up faster.
You mentioned digital divide. I don't recall which legislation. It might have been the infrastructure bill. Now builds out broadband to pretty much every corner of the country. How big of a digital divide is it? Is it rich versus poor, or is it urban versus rural? Tell us a little bit about what the digital divide looks like.
It's both. And the digital divide we were focused on 20 plus years ago was, you know, just getting people connected to the internet, getting computers into, you know, to classrooms and community centers and some level of connectivity. As we've seen with the pandemic, that connectivity, particularly broadband connectivity, is much more important. And mm-hmm. it's now much harder to not just learn, but just function in life without that broadband connectivity. And to your question, it's both. There are different parts of the country that definitely have, you know, slow, in some cases, non-existent internet connectivity. And so those areas are disadvantaged, and this legislation will help there. And obviously, even in big cities, there are parts of the communities that don't have access to high speed as well. So it's become more of a utility that mm-hmm. you know, everybody needs to make sure they can, you know, kind of, you know, compete in this world and participate. And increasingly, healthcare is using telemedicine. Increasingly, education is using telelearning. It's not just about the ability to, you know, get news or buy products. It's also the ability to do some of the most fundamental aspects of our lives. So ubiquitous connectivity is important.
You talk a lot about leveling the playing field. That's an expression you mentioned in terms of access to capital. You mentioned an access to networks, access to internet and broadband. Why is that so important to you?
It's actually something that's sort of been part of everything almost everything I've been involved in. You know, to me, the excitement, the passion in those early days of the internet, I'm talking about the 80s when we were just getting started, and the 90s when the internet was scaling, was I really believed the internet would make the world a better place. The internet would give people access to information, education, commerce, you know, community that they otherwise wouldn't have. And also would level the playing field. That right now, in the early, those early days, there, you know, on the news side, there are only a few news networks like CBS and ABC and so forth.
Right.
Or you maybe, if you were wealthy, you might have owned the local newspaper. There weren't really opportunities for most people's voices to be heard. And so I really felt that the internet could help, you know, create more of those voices and level the playing field. And as you say, the effort in the last decade around Rise the Rest, even the reason I wrote this book on Rise the Rest, is I'm again trying to level the playing field, create more opportunity for more people in more places. And it's just something that drives me. How do you make sure that everybody has a fair shot? The outcomes are going to be different, but the opportunities, you know, for everybody should be much better than they have been.
You mentioned access to information. There's a line from either the book or something you wrote about the book. 100 years ago, the amount of information people would encounter in their lifetime was the same as a daily edition of the New York Times. That's just right. Astonishing.
Yeah, there's been an acceleration of that, and I recognize there's also now some unintended consequences, almost a glut of information and, mm-hmm. and a lot of issues around, you know, what is news and what is fact and so forth, and even in the social media space there have been some challenges. So all these things have some pluses and some minuses. The question is, I think, for society, is how do you maximize the benefits and minimize some of the risks?
Really quite interesting. My last question before we get to our favorites is a little bit of a curveball. You're born and raised in Hawaii, but then relocate to Washington, D.C. That seems like the worst weather trade I've ever seen. D.C. is humid and Hawaii is just delightful. What was it like leaving that behind?
Well, I love Hawaii. I was born and raised there. Both my parents were born and raised there. So our family goes back over 100 years and have investments there and have family there. And do try to get back as often as I can. But for me, I really wanted to pursue a different path than staying there, which led to going to college in Massachusetts, then working in Ohio, then working in Kansas, and then for the last few decades in the Virginia, you know, kind of a D.C. area. And I think that journey, including growing up in Hawaii, as I said before, starting a company and starting AOL in Virginia, I think also informs my views around the Rise of the Rest. I think it's part of the reason I'm so passionate about trying to, you know, create more opportunity for more people in more places. You know, when I grew up in Hawaii, I remember the early days, this would have been, the 70s. We'd get television shows a week late, the satellite technology had not advanced to the point where they could beam them, so we would get them the tapes sent over.
Literally
sent over.
Shipped.
So you had a friend on the mainland, you could find out what's going to happen on the television show this week because it already happened on the television show there last week. And it just, you know, it was a little bit, you know, kind of off the, you know, kind of the beaten path, I guess. And starting AOL in the Tyson's Corner, Virginia area, it was also off the beaten path. As I mentioned before, it was harder to get going there. I think that's why I'm so passionate now about, you know, creating opportunity for entrepreneurs all across the country, backing them in cities all across the country. And that's why I decided to write the book, to tell those stories and give people more of a sense of what's happening out there and more of a sense of what's happening and what could be happening all across America in the future.
Who would have guessed Hawaii was that formative to the worlds of entrepreneurship and venture? All right, so let's jump to our favorite questions that we ask all of our guests, starting with, tell us what kept you entertained during the pandemic. What were you watching or listening to?
Well, we watched not a lot of things. We're not big television watchers, but we definitely watched more during the pandemic when you're locked down.
I think all of us did.
I think one that I remember we watched that I recall, particularly given what's happened recently in the last few weeks with the death of the Queen, was The Crown, which I thought was fabulous. More recently, I mentioned my wife is the chair of the National Geographic Society. They have a partnership with Disney, what's called National Geographic Partners, and as a result have a big presence on Disney Plus. And there's a new series just came out in the last couple of months called America the Beautiful. That's really spectacular.
Oh,
so if
really?
You haven't watched that, you should.
I watched, Earth at Night on National Geographic on Disney, and some of it is just astonishing photography. I'll take a look at America the Beautiful. Tell us about your mentors. Who helped to shape your career?
I think there are different people at different stages. In the early days, I think I really did learn a lot from my parents around kind of taking a long view, working hard, trying to be humble about how you approach things. I got a lot of experience in mentoring at some of the big companies I worked for, like Procter & Gamble in Cincinnati. They have a great training program. In the early days of AOL, I learned a lot from the co-founders, Jim Kimsey and Mark Serve, who were both quite a bit older than I was, and from our venture capitalists. I learned a lot from being able to work with those venture capitalists and getting their perspective on scaling businesses, which I think helped me as a CEO of AOL and also certainly helped now as an investor at Revolution. So I like a lot of people. I'm curious and like to bump into people and ideas and kind of a sponge for different perspectives.
Let's talk about books. What are some of your favorites and what are you reading right now?
Reading right now, actually a book called, be actually of interest to folks who listen to you, called How to Invest by David Rubenstein.
Sure.
The book just came out and it's going to be fun. In a couple of weeks, we're going to do a joint thing in the Economic Club in Washington, D.C., where he's going to interview me about my book, Rise of the Rest. I'm going to interview him about his book, How to Invest. So that should be fun. During the pandemic, my favorite book was A Gentleman in Moscow, this great novel by Amor Towles. It was really quite fascinating.
What sort of advice would you give to a recent college graduate who is interested in a career in either technology, entrepreneurship, or investing?
Well, a couple of things. I'd say, first of all, again, part of the reason I wrote the book on Rise of the Rest, don't assume that you have to be in Silicon Valley or you're going to be on the B team, the junior varsity. What's now happening all across the country is really extraordinary, and that will accelerate over the next decade. So decide what city you want to live in. And you can think of it for personal reasons or for a strategic reason based on the industry you most care about. And maybe at Silicon Valley, but it increasingly won't be. There will be many parts of the country that you should consider living in. Second would be to always remain curious. I've learned a lot from, sometimes by serendipity, just being in the right place at the right time, bumping into somebody, listening to something, reading something, and that helps inform your perspective on things. And a final one is certainly it's my experience with building AOL on the internet more recently, what we've been doing with Rise of the Rest, is this, kind of idea of revolutions happening in evolutionary ways. You have to take a long-term view. You have to be persistent. Sometimes in the entrepreneurial world, people focus too much on the overnight successes. Mark Zuckerberg in his dorm room coming up with Facebook, and a year later it's a global phenomenon. A year later he's a billionaire kind of thing. That's super rare. Most of these things take a while and really are going to be two steps forward, one step back. A lot of near death experiences, and if you really care about it, you keep fighting.
And our final question, what do you know about the world of startups, venture, entrepreneurship, technology today that you wish you knew back in 1985 when you were first launching America Online?
I would say we covered some of this, the importance of partnerships, that almost everything I've done that's had a real impact in the world, it's about partnerships. And so how do you identify opportunities for collaboration that can that can really allow things to scale, that's one of the key things. The second would be, it seems so basic, almost so obvious, but it's true. At the end of the day, it all comes down to people. The people you work with and the people you partner with are going to result in success or failure. And it's not about you. Entrepreneurship is a team sport. How do you assemble kind of the dream team of people with bring different perspectives but work together well in a team? And everything I've that's had success in my life, including AOL and more recently what we've done with Rise of the Rest, we've had the right team. The things that have been struggles, including the merger with AOL and Time Warner, which obviously was a disappointment, we didn't have the people side right. We didn't have the right people focused on the right priorities, working together in the right way. So it's just a reminder to me that you have to constantly take a step back and make sure you really have the people side front and center.
We have been speaking with Steve Case, Chairman and CEO of Revolution. If you enjoy this conversation, be sure and check out any of our previous 400 or so that we've done over the past 8 years. You can find those at iTunes, Spotify, wherever you feed your podcast fix. We love your comments, feedback, and suggestions. Write to us at mibpodcast@bloomberg.net. Follow me on Twitter at Ritholtz. Sign up for my daily reading list at ritholtz.com. I would be remiss if I did not thank the crack team who helps put these conversations together each week. Justin Milner is my audio engineer. Paris Wald is my producer. Sean Russo is my head of research. Atika Valbrun is our project manager. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.